Out front next, breaking news. The four congresswomen who were the targets of Trump's racist rant firing back as the president digs in, defending the indefensible. Plus, Biden's big gamble, the former vice president unveiling his health care plan. But is Obama 2.0 anything like Medicare for all? And the president moves to stop nearly every migrant from seeking asylum. So what's going to happen? Let's go out front. Good evening, I'm Erin Burnett. Out front tonight, the breaking news taking on Trump. The four congresswomen who were the targets of Trump's racist rant moments ago stepped before the cameras to respond to the president.
We are grateful for your solidarity, your encouragement, and your support in the face of the most recent xenophobic, bigoted remarks from the occupant of our White House.
The recent tweets and words from the president are simply a continuation of his racist and xenophobic playbook.
Weak minds and leaders challenge loyalty to our country in order to avoid challenging and debating the policy.
This is the agenda of white nationalists, and now it's reached the White House garden.
This after the president of the United States today not only defended but escalated his racist attacks against the four congresswomen you just heard.
These are people that hate our country. Hey, John, they hate our country. They hate it, I think, with a passion. These are people that, in my opinion, hate our country. And all I'm saying that if they're not happy here, they can leave.
Of course, this country is their country, too. They are in Congress not to agree with him, but to represent their voters and to uphold the United States Constitution. Because let's get to the core of this here, right? Trump says the four women are not from America. His original tweet, reading in part, quote, "So interesting to see progressive Democrat congresswomen who originally came from countries whose governments are a complete and total catastrophe, the worst, most corrupt and inept anywhere in the world." Well, that is racist. And of course, it's also factually wrong. All four of those women, of course, are as American as Trump. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, born in the same city as Trump, New York. Rashida Tlaib, Detroit. Ayanna Pressley, Cincinnati. Congressman Ilhan Omar came to the United States as a child with her father 23 years ago and has been a U.S. citizen since she was a teenager. At this point, you just got to say it like it is, right? It seems clear that Trump believes brown and black people are not legitimately American, at least not like white people. Remember these moments, including his attacks on Obama?
He doesn't have a birth certificate, or if he does, there's something on that certificate that is very bad for him. Perhaps it would be that where it says religion, it might have Muslim.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists.
You had some very bad people in that group, but you also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
Well, tonight, Trump is embracing the fact that white supremacists are embracing his latest racist slam.
Does it concern you that many people saw that tweet as racist and that white nationalist groups are finding common cause with you on that point?
It doesn't concern me because many people agree with me.
Well, those many people include the man who founded the alt-right movement, Richard Spencer, who tweeted Trump's comments helped him win back a sizable portion of the alt-right. And yet, as Trump fans the flames of racism and bigotry, Republicans have been slow to condemn him. It took 15 hours after Trump first sent that tweet for a single Republican to condemn him. And as of tonight, about a dozen Republican lawmakers have spoken out. Some responses, though, are sort of shocking, to be honest. They didn't play dumb, I guess.
You saw the president's tweets this weekend.
Actually, I was out of town.
Oh, I guess they did. Okay. Or, well, at least, right, they didn't say that that tweet saying that the brown and black women weren't from America was up for interpretation.
What did you think of the president going saying that these congresswomen should go back to their country?
Well, I didn't take it that he said that.
He did say that. He said they should go home.
Well, that's the way you interpret the tweet.
No, it's not the way Manu interpreted the tweet. It's what I just read you the tweet said, right? Originally came from countries whose governments are complete and total catastrophe. Look, It's a racist attack, and yet still nothing from Republican leadership. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy was just asked if the tweet was racist. He avoided the question, instead saying it's about the ideology of the Democratic Party. And the office of the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell saying, quote, if he issues a statement on this, we'll be sure to forward it. Well, we'll await that. McConnell, of course, did call the president out for that tape. Remember the one, grab him by the you-know-what? But in so many cases has turned a blind eye, refusing to condemn the president for referring to African nations as blank-hole countries, refusing to call Trump's racist attack on the American judge, Curiel, racist.
Is it a racist statement?
I couldn't disagree more with what he had to say.
Okay, but do you think it's a racist statement to say?
I don't agree with what he had to say.
Well, at this point, there should be no disagreement among Americans, wherever you stand on the political spectrum. Americans should know that it is un-American to fuel and endorse racism. Caitlin Collins is out front live outside the White House. And Caitlin, the president not just refusing to apologize, he's upping the ante. He keeps saying, well, you can leave. He is not backing down.
Yeah, not only is he not backing down, he's escalating these attacks, saying that these four congresswomen hate America and that if they don't like living here, then they should leave the country. He's also widening his attacks to include the Democratic House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, who recently said the president wants to make America white again. When he was asked about that statement today, he said it would be a racist statement if that's something that Pelosi has said, even though just last week he told reporters he did not think Nancy Pelosi was racist. Now, Aaron, the president came ready to defend his tweets over the weekend and his comments today with reporters, because as he spoke at this event that was focused on something totally separately than these remarks, he had two pieces of paper in his hand that had essentially bullet points of what he argued there in front of reporters, with his own classic Sharpie that he likes to use, with edits that he had made. Now this comes and the president is doubling down on these, as even his own aides are struggling to defend the president's remarks, with some of them on camera just outright refusing to acknowledge them, saying that that's something you have to talk to the president about, with others pointing to a naturalization ceremony that the vice president recently attended, which the president did not because he was at his golf course, to his Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, the only cabinet member to weigh in on this so far, who said he did not think the president's tweets were racist. But Aaron, we should note that behind the scenes, very few White House officials are defending the president's comments.
All right. Well, I should hope so. All right. Thank you very much, Caitlin. And let's go now to Democratic Congressman Andre Carson, member of the Congressional Black Caucus, the second Muslim ever elected to Congress. Good to have you with me tonight. And I'm sorry it's to talk about something like this. But Congressman, I want to give you a chance to respond to the president tonight.
Well, I think his comments are consistent with what he's done. He obviously has a problem with strong women. That's evidence. He has a problem with diversity in this country, and that's evidenced by his repeated comments against this country. Look, he's speaking to his base. These comments are timed right along the side of the announcement about the ICE raid, and so I think it's strategic, but it's hurtful as well, and I think that he's showing who he really is.
So to that effect, I want to play an exchange the president had with a reporter about this earlier today. Here he is, Congressman.
Does it concern you that many people saw that tweet as racist and that white nationalist groups are finding common cause with you on that point?
It doesn't concern me because many people agree with me.
I mean, what he wrote was racist. Congressman, did he do that because he's a racist, or did he do it because he's a racist and he thought it would help him politically?
Listen, I don't know his heart, but I can tell you this. It's walking like a duck. It's quacking like a duck. Looks like a duck to me. And so the fact that white supremacists are reaffirming his statements, it says two things. One, he's speaking to that particular segment, that very toxic segment of our society. And secondly, he's throwing a Hail Mary, hoping that he can reassure his base, the base that bought into this mythology, this mythical place that never existed in our country. And so his remarks coming from the highest office in the land, they're destructive, they're hurtful, and dare I say, they're anti-American.
Why do you think Republican leadership has so far failed to condemn the president publicly?
Well, you know, I have friendships with many Republicans, and quietly and privately, they're embarrassed. I can't speak to leadership strategy on this, but I'm disappointed. If they're truly concerned about the preservation of our republic, the preservation of our democracy, as it were, they should condemn the president's remarks so we can move forward on important legislation like building our infrastructure.
Do you think the former president at any point, is it time for him to speak out? President Obama.
You know, I think President Obama has been very bold. I think we can make a mistake in putting too much on President Obama. We have a responsibility as legislators, as political leaders, as activists, as concerned citizens to speak up and condemn the president and to do even more to make sure he is not reelected in 2020.
So the Republican Senator Tim Scott, the only black GOP senator, said in a statement, quote, instead of sharing how the Democratic Party's far left pro-socialist policies, not to mention the hateful language some of their members have used toward law enforcement and Jews, are wrong for the future of our nation, the president interjected with unacceptable personal attacks and racially offensive language. He's calling out the president, but he's also calling out Democrats for saying some pretty hateful and awful things. Is everybody guilty here?
Well, Tim's a friend of mine. I have great respect for Tim. Kudos to Tim for being bold and calling out the president. I think both sides have made provocative statements. I'm not exempt from that, but I think in a very real sense, those provocative statements could never outweigh the very hurtful, the very toxic, and the very destructive statements that the president of the United States keeps making.
I want to ask you one more question. When Mark Short was on this network today, the vice president's chief of staff, he said he did not think the president's tweet was racist. And here's his back and forth with a reporter today.
How is it not racist to tell women of color to go back to their countries when most of them were born here anyway and they're all U.S. citizens?
Kristen, he has an Asian woman of color in his cabinet.
But what does that have to do with lashing out at poor women of color?
Because I'm making the case that this is not a universal statement that he's making. He's making it about the very specific, pretty much the individual member of Congress that I think has said most things that she's most unhappy about the United States of America.
So he's referencing Elaine Chao as proof that the president is not a racist against women. Your response?
Well, I think Madam Chao has served in previous administrations, so she could speak for herself. The focus is on President Trump and his comments that are destructive, that are racist, that are hateful, that are xenophobic, in many ways Islamophobic. And I think that the focus should be on President Trump. President Trump has shown repeatedly that he cannot be trusted. He's shown that he's calculating and appealing to his base, but those calculations, those miscalculations, were proved to have been ineffective in 2020. That's my hope.
Congressman Carson, I appreciate your time. Thanks tonight.
Thank you.
And next, one Republican senator justifying Trump's racist attack, insisting you can't change a 73-year-old man. Is that an excuse? Plus, Joe Biden pushing back against his Medicare for All happy rivals. Is his Obamacare Plus plan going to work, though, when it comes to the primary? And an historic case pitting one state against an iconic company, Johnson & Johnson. Are they about to pay tens of billions for opioids? Breaking news. As Democratic congresswomen respond to Trump's racist attacks, world leaders are slamming President Trump's tweets. A spokesman for British Prime Minister Theresa May saying that Trump telling the women to go back where they came from was, quote, completely unacceptable. And here's Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
That is not how we do things in Canada. A Canadian is a Canadian is a Canadian. And the diversity of our country is actually one of our greatest strengths.
Out front now, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Carl Bernstein and White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Network's April Ryan. So, Carl, obviously you have covered politics for many years, many presidents. Did you ever think you would see a president speak like President Trump just has?
Not out loud. This is a watershed moment in the history of the country, and it should be, because this was no dog whistle. This was the expression of a rabid dog expressed as racism, the rabid dog of American racism, unambiguous expressed by the President of the United States in a way that no other president has. And it's time that the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, does the Republican Party want to be defined as a racist party? That's really the big question here, and it's a big question for the press as well, because the press has got to make this a continuing story in which we go to all members of Congress who are Republicans and try to get them on the record about what they really think about this. And let's really stay with this story.
So April, let me just ask you, because obviously there's been a deafening silence. There are some who have spoken up and done so firmly, and I want to make sure that everybody knows that, a dozen of them. But many others, and we just gave some examples, have not. President Trump, of course, April, though, knew when he tweeted that, right, that they were American citizens. He knows that full well. He knows AOC was born in New York, the same as he was. He did it anyway, right? So he did it knowing it wasn't true. He did it deliberately. What is his strategy?
Aaron, you know his strategy. We all know his strategy. This is an election season, and he wants to bring back that core, that core group that believes these crazy things. And I'm going to go back to something that happened last year that really riled people up. And I'm going to take my time with this, Aaron. January 2018, I asked the President of the United States, Mr. President, are you a racist, in the Roosevelt Room? And I received a lot of hate calls that I'm a race baiter from his supporters, and conservative media went in on me. But the reason why I asked, because the laundry list was long and people really did not jump about it. The laundry list included Charlottesville, the Exonerated Five, which was once known as the Central Park Five, his housing practices, S-hole nations, the list goes on. And then let's talk about how he has attacked minority women. Let's start with Congresswoman Maxine Waters, Congresswoman Frederica Wilson. Let's even bring in a royal, Meghan Merkel. Let's talk about minority female reporters, Yamiche Alcindor, our own Abby Phillip, and April Ryan, myself. This is not a dog whistle issue. This is a blaring bullhorn issue. And I'm going to go back to something my CNN colleague and former Florida gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum said. Mr. President, I'm not saying you're racist, but the racists think you're racist. So if the president and his followers are very upset, but if the president and his followers are concerned about the words racist and linking that to the president, he needs to check his tweets. He needs to check his words. And at this moment, I'm going to say, Mr. President, if you don't want us asking the questions or saying you're a racist, stop acting like a racist.
Well, you know, Carl, I think, April, you said it so well when you said, well, the racists think you're a racist. Clearly they do, as we just showed Richard Spencer there. I'm curious, though, Richard, Carl, from your perspective, Republican John Cornyn, one of the ones who commented today, obviously senior, he said, Senator, I don't think you're going to change someone at this point in his life. So he's saying, I don't like it, but you're not going to change anybody. Are you worried that that's too much of the attitude on the Republican side?
I think the attitude of the Republican side so far in this presidency has been craven in terms of challenging President Trump on the most outrageous of his statements and actions, his contempt for the law in many cases, his contempt for American traditions in terms of who we are as a people fighting racism, trying to move forward and bring the country together. He's never tried to do that. Look, he is known to those who have been with him for a long time, who know him the longest. He is known as a hater. You can read the biographies of him. You can go back to people who have gone to school with him, who have worked for him. And hate is a piston of this presidency. We need to focus our reporting in a very calm way on biography and on this whole question of race in this election as expressed today in this moment by the President of the United States in a way that we've never heard before. And it needs to be the central issue put before the American people by the press in a dispassionate way.
Now, I am curious.
Facts, this is racist.
I am curious, though, whether this is, you know, April, in your judgment, driven in the president, or perhaps you're going to say both, more by race or more by gender. We're talking about four black and brown women.
And I know, I know. Black women to him don't rank, and he wants to send brown people back across the border. So race and gender are, for this president, conjoined twins. I'm really hopeful. There's something, Aaron, there's something new that's on the horizon next week that I'm hopeful about. That maybe the president can come to grips and start talking about why he says this. Explain himself. As a reporter, I want to hear where this is coming from and why he's doing this. The NAACP has their national convention next week, and they have offered him a prime opportunity on the 24th of July to talk about black and brown America, and I'm going to be the moderator of the presidential forum, and I'm going to ask him about this and other things, because this is important as we are talking about the fabric of America, not just one part of America.
Well,
we're talking about women who made the quilt, and we're talking about people. This is humanity. This is not politics.
Well,
and
at the least it would be an opportunity to
actually support the nation.
At least it would be an opportunity to drown out Bob Mueller in part, which no doubt he wants to do on that day.
And that's on that day.
Certainly something like
that's
this
right.
would get some notice. Thank you both so very much. And next, Joe Biden already having to defend his new health care plan that pits him against his more progressive rivals.
I understand the appeal of Medicare for all, but folks supporting it should be clear that it means getting rid of Obamacare. And I'm not for that.
Plus, Trump had tanks at his parade, but the French, ooh la la, just one-upped him. The fight for 2020, Joe Biden taking a huge risk, taking a stand against Medicare for All, which his top 2020 rivals support. Instead, he is betting on Obamacare.
I believe we have to protect and build on Obamacare. I understand the appeal of Medicare for All, but folks supporting it should be clear that it means getting rid of Obamacare. And I'm not for that. I'm surprised that so many Democrats are running on getting rid of it.
Jeff Zeleny is out front. So, Jeff, Joe Biden says protect and build on Obamacare, which, of course, has taken a huge hit when President Trump took away the mandate and costs surged for anyone to sign up for those plans. How does Biden plan on doing this?
Well, Aaron, what he's doing here, politically speaking, he is essentially throwing down the gauntlet against Bernie Sanders, against Elizabeth Warren, against Kamala Harris, saying Medicare for All simply isn't workable. But here's what he's proposing. He's proposing an expansion of Obamacare. Let's take a look at a couple key provisions here that he is calling for today. He would launch a government-run public option. Essentially extend tax credits to help Americans buy lower price insurance. This is one of the things that was discussed early on when this bill was still being debated back, you know, almost a decade ago. It also would allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices, and it comes with an estimated price tag of $750 billion over a decade. So, Aaron, you'll remember back when the House and the Senate were debating this in the early years of the Obama presidency, this was one of the ideas that many people in the House of Representatives with that public option wanted to do, but it simply would not have passed muster in the Senate. Now this is looking like, you know, a moderate program. At the time, it looked like a very liberal program. Mm-hmm. But Aaron, the question here is this: would it bring the prices down enough for people? But what the former vice president is betting on, is banking on, is the fact that people do not want to get rid of their private health insurance. So Bernie Sanders, Senator Warren, Senator Harris are essentially putting themselves in a box. He's making a bet that the party's more in the middle of the road here, but he's also going against the liberal wing of the party. But Aaron, this is the most significant distinction that he has made yet with his top rivals.
All right, Jeff Zeleny, thank you very much. And it's a distinction that could make a world of difference one way or the other. Out front now, senior advisor to the Biden campaign, Simone Sanders. She also was the national press secretary for Bernie Sanders during the 2016 campaign. So, Simone, you know this from every angle, okay? Mm-hmm. As a general idea, Simone, a lot of people like the idea of Medicare for All, right? And that's in part because it sort of rings like it's free. Medicare for All, right? But it is not free. It has an estimated price tag of $3 trillion a year. People who are on Medicare can pay huge amounts of money out of pocket for things like cancer drugs, which could almost certainly mean payroll tax, income tax increases, right? It is not free, but it sounds that way to a lot of people. How can you, Nick, explain that to Democratic-based voters? That Medicare for All may sound good, but doesn't really come out that way.
So thanks for having me tonight, Aaron. I think it's important to note that healthcare is really such a so important to the American experiment, so important to folks' lives, and that is why people have such a visceral reaction when we have a conversation about healthcare. The 2016 to 2018 election, one could argue, in the House of Representatives was decided on this point about mm-hmm. healthcare. Republicans were trying to take away healthcare, and Democrats were running on really shoring up and protecting Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And so today, Vice President Biden released his plan for his Biden health care plan. And as Jeff said, Aaron, we are really drawing a line in the sand here, and that we believe health care is a right. We believe health care is a right for every American. We believe that health care is so important, and we believe folks have to be covered. We believe in universal coverage. And the way that Vice President Biden is going to get there is through this through this public option, with this expansion of Medicare, and also make sure that folks who are currently eligible for Medicaid but live in states where governors and state legislatures have failed to act, right, those individuals can opt into their new plan.
But I'm just trying to understand. Are you trying to also explain to voters that Medicare for All is not free, right? It comes at immense cost. You're
Aaron,
trying to come up with another option.
It's not for me to explain. Let me just hold on a second. It's not for me to explain anything about Medicare for All to the voters. If the Sanders campaign or any of the other campaigns that would like to propose a Medicare for All plan want to be clear about what it is that they believe and what their plan is for the American people, I think it's important for them to do that. Look, I...
Okay, but hold on, because I get what you're saying. You want to talk about yours and not theirs, but the reason I'm pushing so hard on this is that it's popular. And when you look at Democratic-based voters, Simone, as I know you know better than anybody, our latest CNN poll shows more Democratic voters trust Bernie Sanders on health care. And if you combine him with Warren, you're well north of 40%. That's the Medicare for All crowd. So how do you tell those voters Medicare for All doesn't add up? Our alternative is better, and here's why.
So, Aaron, again, I want to take you back to 2018. In 2018, I know Republican strategists would have liked for folks at home to believe that Democrats across the country were running on open borders and Medicare for All, but that's not what folks were running on. We were running on was putting a check on this president, on Donald Trump. Folks were running on was protecting Obamacare. And then, after we've protected Obamacare, building on that success. And so what I think what we are explaining to voters and saying is, we're out on the campaign trail this week, the vice president is out there right now, is that we have to protect Obamacare. Obamacare is under assault right now from this very administration. The Trump administration is in court arguing to take health care away from millions of Americans. And while we're defending it, we also have to put plans together to build on the enormous success that is Obamacare. And that is what the plan that Vice President Biden has put forth. Now, there are folks, Aaron, that are going to argue otherwise. There are people that want to say, well, we want to go further.
So
I ask those people to tell folks how you're going to pay for it and explain to people what is going to happen to them. So it's not enough just to say we all believe in universal health care. In this particular primary, we have to talk about what that specific plan for health care means. And we have put ours on the table. I encourage other campaigns to do the same.
So let me just ask you, though, because Medicare for All, on this point, you used to, and in your prior role with working with Bernie Sanders, you know, you intellectually came to the conclusion that you could have Obamacare, add to it, and get Medicare for All. And obviously now you're saying that it's different, right? Because Joe Biden is saying you can't. You can't have Medicare for All and Obamacare because Medicare would replace Obamacare. Here you are back in 2016. And I want to play it, Simone, because I want to give you a chance to explain to everybody how you came to change your mind. Here you are.
Thinking big is how we get change in this country. Thinking big is how we got the Affordable Health Care Act. And thinking big is how we're going to build on that with a Medicare for All single-payer system. When we talk about a Medicare for All single-payer system, we're talking about universal health care. We're not talking about doing away with Obamacare, with the Affordable Health Care Act. We are talking about building on its enormous success.
So now Joe Biden says that Medicare for All would get rid of Obamacare. What is he doing
different? For just a second, because I unequivocally reject what is being set up here. What I just saw, to be clear, let me just be really clear for a second. Yes, in 2016, I served as the press secretary for Senator Sanders. I'm extremely proud of the work that I did on that campaign and the work that I have gone on to do since when I left the campaign in June of 2016. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you something. talking about universal health care has been a very popular point in the Democratic Party. It's been, you know, popular in places across the country. Frankly, it's popular with Republican voters and independents alike. Yeah. But when you talk about health care, when you talk about coverage, we have to talk about specific plans. And what in 2016, we were having these conversations. What Senator Sanders has put on the table is not an expansion of Obamacare. It is not. It does away with private insurance. And what is currently on the table in his Medicare for All plan says that Obamacare isn't enough, that we have to go on and do something else. This is not an expansion. Now, if the Sanders campaign would like to say it's an expansion, I hope you would welcome them onto your program to have that conversation. But for anyone to suggest, that because I work for Vice President Biden, now I feel differently, that's just not true. I welcome a conversation.
No, I want to be clear.
No, but I want to be clear.
I'm not suggesting you feel differently. No, I'm suggesting, Simone, let me say why I played that. No, I want to be clear.
Simone, let me finish my sentence. Hold on.
I didn't say it to do a gotcha. I said it because what you said then is different than what you're saying now. You're a thoughtful, smart person. You've changed your mind. And I want to give you a chance to explain to people why.
Because, Aaron, I believe in building on the enormous success of Obamacare. But the plan that is currently on the table that is being discussed by a number of folks when they talk about Medicare for All, specifically Senator Sanders' plan, does not do that. And that is the difference. And so if the Sanders campaign or anyone else would like to assert otherwise, I welcome the conversation. Our campaign obviously welcomes the debate because health care is so important to millions of people across America.
Well,
but I just want to be very clear that there are values and things that anchor me. And I know that there are a lot of people on social media that get into the minutia of what's going on in a Democratic presidential primary, but I am proud to be on a campaign that cares about millions of Americans, that's putting forth ideas, that is not about tearing down or attacking other Democrats, that understands that the goal here is to get Donald Trump out of the White House, is to put forth a plan that takes us further, that doesn't take us back. And so if other Democrats want to have conversations about other things, they can do what they want. We're focused on the issues. Right. And we'll see you at the debate at the end of this month.
And to be clear, Simone, I think the fact that you do have this history is why people should listen to you and your evolution and why you think what you think, because it's important, because the issue does matter to you. That's why what you said then and now I think should matter to a lot of people so they can understand it and make a smart and informed decision on which person to back. And I appreciate your time, as always. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And next, in a dramatic move, the Trump administration making it a lot harder now for people to seek asylum in the United States. So, will it stop hundreds of thousands of migrants? Plus, one of the world's largest drug makers being sued for its alleged role in the opioid crisis. The case could cost Johnson & Johnson, the baby oil company, tens of billions of dollars. The man leading the charge is out front. Tonight, no asylum. Trump moving to block hundreds of thousands of people from seeking asylum along the U.S.-Mexico border. The new rule takes effect tomorrow. It bans anyone from claiming asylum in the United States if they pass through another country to get here, which means only Mexicans can apply for asylum coming from Mexico. The thing is, very few, almost none do. The people who are coming from Mexico are from places like Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. And that apparently ends tomorrow. Ed Lavandera is out front.
In March, Idania Toledo de la Rosa and her husband left Cuba with their son to seek asylum in the United States. They flew to Nicaragua on a visa and then traveled through Central America and Mexico to reach this shelter in Juarez, Mexico.
So when they arrived here in Juarez in mid-May, the family had no idea that there would be so many people here seeking asylum and that there would be so many obstacles to get across into the United States. And she says she's trying to reunite with her son who lives in Florida.
Their four-month-long journey has them at America's doorstep. They can see downtown El Paso from inside the shelter where they've been living since May. But taking the last few steps just became even tougher. The Trump administration has put a new rule in place that bars migrants traveling through Mexico from claiming asylum at the U.S. southern border. Immigration officials say it will dramatically limit the ability of Central Americans, Cubans, and migrants from places other than Mexico to seek asylum at ports of entry. Right now, more than a dozen shelters in Juarez alone are filled with migrants waiting to seek asylum.
The president of the United States should be doing what he is in the immigration space, and that is in focusing
on trying to fix an obviously broken system when we look at the border when he's getting almost no help from Congress.
As they sit and wait in Mexico, Daniel Sigas says his family is running out of options.
They have no choice. He says they can't go back to Cuba. He says where they come from, Cuba, they're scared of the government. Here in Juarez, they're scared of everything that's around them, everything that's beyond these walls.
Immigrant rights advocates say U.S. asylum laws are one of the vital cornerstones of American immigration policy, while President Trump has called asylum laws absolutely insane.
Some of these people are holding their country's flags and waving their country's flags, and then they talk about the fear they have of being in the country that the flag they were waving freely.
In reality, migrants waving their homeland's flags are an extremely rare sight on the southern border. There's a sign in Juarez, Mexico, that every migrant watches closely. When they arrive at the border, migrants register for their number in line to cross into the United States. More than 11,000 people have had their number called, and each day a few more numbers are added to this tally. But nearly 18,000 people, according to Juarez officials, are waiting. That's almost 6,000 people left in limbo.
So, Aaron, the real-life implications of all of this will remain to be seen. We'll see how migrants there waiting in limbo there along the U.S. southern border will react to this. But a legal challenge is coming. The American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, says they will mount a legal challenge to this new rule. Aaron?
All right. Thank you very much, Ed. And next, an historic case against one of the biggest drug makers in the United States, Oklahoma, suing Johnson & Johnson over opioids. And this case could be one of the biggest this country has ever seen. Plus, Jeannie Moss on how the French one-upped President Trump with a flying, gun-toting man. New tonight, paying for allegedly pimping opioids. A judge is tonight weighing whether Johnson & Johnson, the company behind baby oil and no-tear shampoo, should pay more than $17 billion. For playing a key part in the opioid epidemic. This could be the single biggest case in the opioid crisis and set the stage for how this entire country has the blame in this crisis, whether it is on big drug companies. Out front now, the man who is leading the charge, Republican Attorney General Mike Hunter of Oklahoma. And Attorney General, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much. Obviously, we've been watching this case as you have gone through this in recent weeks. And I am so happy to finally have you on the program. How confident are you that you are going to win?
Very confident. Of course, it's with the judge now, but we feel really good about the case that we have presented to him. We've demonstrated that the defendant, Johnson & Johnson, has been the prime provider of the raw ingredient for opioids for the rest of the opioid manufacturing industry, almost 60% for the last couple of decades. We've demonstrated their misrepresentation of the addictive qualities of their products. And we did the job that we felt like we needed to do to provide the judge the evidence and the testimony he needed to make a good decision.
Now, you know, you're mentioning here, that you think you have proof that Johnson & Johnson knew that what they were doing was addictive. They knew people were dying, and yet they played down those risks aggressively. What do you think was your slam dunk to prove that? That they knew and that they purposely buried it under the rug?
Well, the idea that you can just be completely deaf, dumb, and blind with regard to the fact that you've increased supply into this country by a factor of 9 or 10, and deaths are going up by a factor of 10 to 15, and you're not going to do anything about it, you're not going to take any kind of cognizance as an important, as a responsible corporate citizen, they knew what was going on. They just couldn't afford to quit doing it.
I mean, when you say 9 to 10 times the supply, 10 to 15 times the people dying, I mean, they say tonight that you're just making them a, quote, scapegoat. What do you say to them?
Well, there's another term I've used and we've used in the trial, and that's kingpin. When you devise a multi-decade plan to move into the pain franchise, to provide the raw product for the rest of the industry, and you not only sell opioids, again, you provide the raw material for the rest of the industry, you help your partners in the industry promote in an unbranded way opioids. You tell doctors that, hey, don't really worry about addiction. This stuff is something you need to provide your patients whenever they have the least amount of pain. So We have proved our case, I believe, but it's up to the judge. And I just have to say, this judge has done a remarkable job of being fair and even-handed in administering this trial.
The testimony in this case has been emotional. One for a person who testified was Craig Box. His son, Austin, former linebacker for the Oklahoma Sooners, died of an overdose. He was 22 years old. Here's his father, Craig.
He graduated. He graduated from the University of Oklahoma the Saturday before he died on a Thursday. We heard from so many parents across the that have lost children in similar circumstances.
How do you think people at companies like Johnson & Johnson or Purdue Pharmaceuticals and the Sackler family, how did they know about things like that and look the other way?
I don't know. It's a function, more than anything else, of profit over patience. I mean, I told the judge today, I think there's a one-word answer, and that's greed. They were making hundreds of millions of dollars, and they could not afford to quit making hundreds of millions of dollars. As far as I'm concerned, Johnson & Johnson was in this up to their neck. Again, we're confident that they've got responsibility here, and we're going to hold them accountable. And again, we feel really good about our case and the fact the judge is going to do the right thing.
Attorney General Hunter, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Aaron.
And next, Jeannie Moos on the Flying Frenchman, who President Trump may want in Washington. Tonight, Trump's 4th of July was inspired by France's Bastille Day. Trump wanted to top Bastille Day. It's really hard to do. Did France just outdo him? Here's Jeannie.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's the flyboard guy who stole the show at the Bastille Day parade in Paris.
Faster than a speeding bullet.
Actually, the flyboard air's top speed is around 118 miles an hour. That's the inventor and entrepreneur, Frankie Zapata, operating the flyboard.
We have one remote control.
French President Emmanuel Macron watched approvingly as fans compared it to everything from Marty McFly's Back to the Future hoverboard to that flying villain, the Green Goblin.
Hello, my dear.
But making the Green Goblin a reality is enough to make a certain someone green with envy. President Trump loves toys. At Monday's Made in America event, he boarded a boat and got behind the wheel of a Thad missile defense vehicle. Remember what happened last time he watched a French parade? He liked it so much, he said, I'll have what they're having. And on the 4th of July, we had a bevy of flybys. But now the French have one-upped everyone. Maybe by next 4th of July, we'll see the commander-in-chief commanding his own flyboard. Frankie Zapata's next stunt will be to fly across the English Channel, since the turbine-powered engines allow for at least 10 minutes flying time. That will require mid-flight refueling. Flyboard development got a grant from the French military, though some were skeptical of its usefulness and survivability. The parade featured everything from horses to robots and even anti-drone guns, which could probably take the fly out of a flyboard as well. By the way, that rifle was reported to be unloaded or fake, and even the French haven't figured out how to kiss through a helmet. Jeannie Moos, CNN.
Would be like a rocket ship.
New York.
And thank you so much for joining us. Have a good night. See you tomorrow. Anderson starts now.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.